The first reading this morning comes from the book Journey Toward Freedom, the story of Sojourner Truth. It was written a long time ago, in 1967, by Jacqueline Bernard. Sojourner Truth, once a slave, was one of the most articulate spokespersons for human rights in the 19th century. This passage speaks of Bell's time in New York City. Bell was her given name, not Sojourner yet at the time that this is talking about. She claimed the name Sojourner some years later. By the way, we have no idea how old she was or when she was born because slaves didn't have birthdays.
The future seemed to hold all the promise Bell had once imagined to be contained in that simple word, freedom. But the problem that had seemed easiest to solve, when she was looking at all those spires rising above the harbor, turned out to be the most difficult. Bell could not find a church to attend. She had first chosen the leading Methodist church of New York City. Arriving at the door one Sunday, neatly clad in her heavy new shoes and a black gown, she had handed the elder standing there a letter of introduction from her church in Ulster County. He read it politely and said, "Would you be so kind as to return in the afternoon when the colored class meets?" No, she would not attend a segregated church, she told him. She tried several more churches and finally had to settle for one run by blacks for blacks. The founders were people who had grown tired of sitting in the colored class of a white church. Their church was segregated too, of course, but not because her people chose to have it so. White folks were welcome in the black church, but they never came.
The second reading comes from Henry Osawa Tanner, a spiritual biography, written 8 years ago by Marcus Bruce. The letters AME stands for African Methodist Episcopal, as an African Methodist Episcopal Church. Henry Osawa's father was a very influential bishop in that church. And if you don't know who this artist is, I really urge you to look him up on the internet after the service. Go to Google, type in his name. His painting of the Annunciation of the angel Gabriel to Mary is, to my mind, one of the greatest religious paintings ever made. It's absolutely stunning. It's the only depiction of an angel without any physical form that I've ever seen. It's really worth looking at.
The notion of life as a vocation was deeply rooted in the religious traditions of the AME Church. In fact, it was the very reason the AME Church, the first African American denomination, had been formed. No one knew this better than Bishop Tanner, who played a major role in shaping the church's theological outlook and polity and devotion. In his brilliant book, An Apology for African Methodism, Bishop Tanner identified the central mission of the church as the vindication of the humanity of the African American. When Richard Allen, the founder of the predominantly black denomination, was denied a place among Anglo-American Methodists, the bishop wrote, they withdrew to form their own denomination and to organize a church with two fundamental purposes. One, to affirm the belief that God made all equal, and two, to establish an institution where the African Americans' claims to humanity would be practically recognized. Thus, Henry Tanner grew up within a family, church, and community that viewed the struggle to establish the humanity of African Americans and their right to determination as a sacred calling.
Southern trees bearing bring strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south. The bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolias, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck. For the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the trees to drop. Here is a strange and bitter.
Jolinda and I went to visit the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church on Bryden Road this last Wednesday. In their social hall, you'll find a splendid mural in soothing blue depicting portraits of famous members of their national church. Harriet Tubman, whom Jolinda will lift up in a moment. Sojourner Truth, part of whose story was in our first reading. And Frederick Douglass, whose strong words we spoke earlier. Next to them, the women and men less famous, the institutionalists who shepherded that particular denomination from its beginning into the strong presence it has today. Now, as most of you know, our own congregation is part of the social justice organization called BRAD, a community of congregations, Unitarian Universalist, Jewish, Muslim, Protestant, Catholic, Anabaptist, and Pentecostal. We consist of historically black congregations, historically white congregations, historically Latino congregations, and now, with the addition of the mosque, an historically cross-cultural community. Every year we meet at large action meetings or smaller planning meetings, and we encounter different religious expressions at these meetings. Often we Unitarian Universalists feel a bit misunderstood. Our religious practices and styles of theology and overt skepticism seem unique, and we sometimes experience misinterpretation of who we are and what we do. I've got news. All the other groups feel exactly the same way. But since our congregation is engaged right now in specific anti-racist work, Jolinda and I thought it might be a good idea to offer some insight about the historic African-American congregations with whom we meet. Social justice isn't just a number of specific actions at meetings, after all. It's growing knowledge, the critique of mere assumptions, and deep, deep self-reflection.
The great African-American artist Jacob Lawrence wrote and illustrated in saturated, sometimes jarring images, a children's book about the great liberator Harriet Tubman. It was, without rival, my elder daughter's favorite book as a preschooler. If you're a parent or a grandparent of a young child, consider it for your library. Anyway, if you spent much time with a preschooler, you know what it's like to deal with a child with a favorite book. You read it over and over and over again, even though they have every word memorized. While Lawrence had a rare talent as a painter, a poet he was not. So night after night, I repeated, "Harriet, Harriet, born a slave, work for her master from cradle to grave." And similar couplets until we finally reached, "Harriet, Harriet, born to be free, led her people to liberty." I'm not exactly sure why that so appealed to Heather. Those of you who know that my family is multiracial may be assuming that this was my African-American daughter, but it isn't. Heather is of European, including Jewish ancestry. My African-American daughter is the one with the Jewish name, Aviva. And Aviva was pretty fearless as a preschooler. Heather was somewhat timid. The world was often frightening for her. Perhaps it was Harriet's bravery in the face of danger and even unimaginable abuse that served as a reassuring role model for her. What gave Harriet Tubman such bravery, such audacity? She would probably say her God and her gun. Something of her life can help us understand the role that religion and the African American church has played in the history of America, in the life of African American communities, and in the lives of individual African Americans. Harriet's childhood was horrible, almost beyond imagination. The worst of it began when she was probably no more than five, and she was hired out by her owner to care for a baby. Anytime the baby woke and cried, Harriet was cruelly whipped and carried those scars all her life. Her mother worked too hard to spend much time with her, but one thing she never forgot were the stories her mother told her from the Hebrew Bible, the stories of escape and of deliverance. When she was a young teen, she was hit in the head, accidentally, it's said, by a white man, maybe her owner, maybe another slaveholder, with a block of iron. She was never treated, and ever after, she suffered from seizures and severe headaches. She also gained visions. Visions that seemed to relate to the stories her mother had told her. She became a devout Christian and believed in the power of prayer. In her early 20s, she heard that her owner was trying to sell her. She reports that she prayed fervently that the Lord would soften his heart. And when that didn't happen, she changed her prayer and prayed that he would die. A week later, he did die. And she expressed regret for her prayers. She realized she had a lot more to regret. The death of her owner meant that she would surely be sold. Even though she loved her husband dearly and deeply, she loved freedom more. She took off for the promised land with two of her brothers. Her brothers turned back. Tubman continued to a place of safety where she could be free, the promised land. In Tubman's life and work, we can see the convergence of two major streams of influence on what we sometimes call today the Black Church. These two streams developed at roughly the same time during the first part of the 19th century. In the South, the segregated Black churches associated with white denominations grew rapidly, sometimes outstripping the white membership. Many more attended church with whites in the area, and others worshiped on their plantations, either with white itinerant preachers or in makeshift services led by the slaveholder. Still others had no access to worship services. All who did worship became tired of propaganda in the guise of spiritual experience. Escaped slave Henry Atkinson said of his church experience, The white clergymen don't preach the whole gospel there. The whole gospel, Atkinson meant, was this. Many of the stories from the Hebrew Bible were censured by the slaveholders as too dangerous. Like Tubman, the slaves heard the stories anyway. Stories that spoke to them, like the Exodus from Egypt. And many came together to worship in a way that satisfied their souls. They did it in secret. In some places, meeting together could cost you your life if you were a slave. In all places, if you were caught, you would surely be punished severely. So they met late at night, with guards all around to sound the alarm, sometimes in the slave quarters, singing and preaching in a whisper. In the woods, or in a pit, in a fallow field, disguised, covered over. Thus, this form of church is called the invisible institution. In these services, both their worship style and their theology filter the teachings and forms of their new American religion through their own experience. Albert Rabiteau, a scholar of African-American religious history, says of the importance of Exodus, and I quote, "The story of the Exodus contradicted the claim made by the defenders of slavery that God intended African Americans to be slaves. On the contrary, Exodus proved that slavery was against God's will and that slavery would end someday." End quote. Exodus was also proof against the claim of inferiority. As with the Israelites, they reason, the slaves were God's chosen people. Perhaps more valuable was the freedom in the moment. Once hidden away, people whose every move was prescribed and proscribed had the freedom to be their authentic selves. Their form of worship was drawn as much from African religious practices as from the religion of the slaveholders. While they were hidden away, the rhythms and dances were the rhythms and dances of their childhood. Probably more salient was the spirit-infused nature of worship, which was a gift of the African religious practices of, say, the Yoruba religion. Rabiteau quotes a slave in his book, Canaan Land. "It ain't enough to talk about God. You've got to feel him moving on the altar of your heart." For those few hours, hidden away, there was real freedom. They answered to no one except their God, a God who, like the high gods of West Africa, was on the side of the poor, the outcast, and the suffering, and who was made known when they gathered. They didn't neglect the freedom in the rest of their lives, however. The spiritual gospel train that Joanna Lowenstein sang so powerfully is a good example of music that came from the invisible institution. Many believe that it announced the arrival of someone like Harriet Tubman, or that it announced some independent group that was gathering to escape. Many other spirituals and work songs may have encoded map instructions for how to escape north and find, say, Columbus, Ohio, where our own ancestors, universalists like the Keltons on Town Street, welcomed escaped slaves into their lives.
Jolinda described the two streams of the African-American denominations in this country. These were concisely summarized by historian George Rawick back in the 1960s. The first stream he called enabling religion, although I think if he was writing now, he would probably use more current words like empowering or liberating. This kind of religion, he said, was a religion of protest about this world, a religion of demand, solidarity, and strength. The other kind of religion he called coping religion. This, he said, was about surviving this world in preparation for the next. But even this idea of the next world need not always be understood in some literal way as a place in the clouds after death. The next world also refers to the time after this present time, when coping is not your daily struggle, and you can get on with just living life, a day in the future, in other words, here on earth, not a day in the clouds. And to this day, in the Black Church, of whatever denomination, dressing for the next world is the common practice. Magnificent hats, astonishing fabric, precise and flattering tailoring. Dressing for the clouds? No, dressing for the days to come when privilege is universal, not hoarded by the few who keep power and decisions for themselves. Both of these streams, Rawick describes, fused over the years into two significant denominations founded just after the American Revolution, as our own Universalist Church was being founded. These were the African Methodist Episcopal Church, founded in Philadelphia in 1797, and the African Methodist Episcopal Church Zion, founded around the same time, in New York City. A century later, another denomination, and now the largest African American church, rose for slightly different reasons. That was and is the Church of God in Christ, which is a Pentecostal church. That is, a church which teaches two things beyond what traditional Protestant Christianity teaches, namely the practice of baptizing people in the Holy Spirit and the practice of living in such a way that it's possible to totally transcend what they call the temptations of the flesh, achieving, they believe, a kind of perfection. This is called the holiness movement. There are also a number of Baptist congregations and associations which have historically been part of the African American church, including Ebenezer Baptist Church and its association of congregations, which nurtured the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. But the first two denominations in particular, and the last, King's Baptist denomination, were founded for reasons made plain in the first reading about Sojourner Truth. She wanted to attend an integrated church. She really did. But she was told to hang out at the African American hour later in the day. This, very friendly-like, mind you, by the greeter at the largest Methodist church in New York City, where she was then living. So she attended instead the Mother Church, as it's often called, of the AME Zion denomination, which, like its sister denominations founded just after the Revolutionary War, remained a place where African American children could grow up to be human, not categories, where young men and young women like those in our ingathering story today could learn leadership skills and institutional savvy, when women like Harriet Tubman brought elderly slaves up out of the South, she was able to welcome them into well-managed homes run by the institutional Black churches, the AME and the AME Zion. The historic African American churches are not that different from the historic white churches with European roots. Same theology, prayer books, singing, hymns, communion, baptism, sermons. But the most important thing about these congregations was their nurturing of their own, the strengthening for moral leadership which had been entirely denied them in the white churches. The AME Church was founded, for example, by men who had watched young Black men at prayer being yanked up forcefully off their knees by white churchgoers, since kneeling was considered excessive behavior by the whites. So, as the second reading makes clear, the historic Black churches were founded by people like Richard Allen, quote, to establish an institution where the African American's claims to humanity would be practically realized and recognized. Thus, the biographer concludes about his subject, Henry Tanner grew up within a family, a church, and a community that viewed the struggle to establish the humanity of African Americans and their right to self-determination as a sacred calling. Imagine you having to find a place where it's safe to practice being human, a place where you can kneel if you want or don't want, only as you determine it, or as in our story this morning, where you can eat wherever you choose to eat. Interestingly, the largest black church, the Church of God in Christ, was founded 100 years after the first black churches. But it was not founded to provide a place to be human, but to express a very particular and purest theological understanding. The Assemblies of God, a huge Pentecostal denomination, was founded by white ministers trained by an African-American preacher named Reverend Seymour, who preached what I referred to earlier as the perfection or holiness doctrine. If Sojourner Truth came to New York City today and looked for an integrated church, she actually might find a Pentecostal church where the strictness of the doctrine and the loyalty to it has transcended most of the issues associated with black and white spiritualities.
It was a Baptist HBCU, or historically black college or university, that finally awarded me a bachelor's degree after more than 30 years and probably 7 years of accumulated credits. For my orientation paper, I researched the history of Arkansas Baptist College and other HBCUs. My alma mater was founded as the Minister's Institute in 1884, just 21 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. It was funded, planned, and run by the colored Baptist of the state of Arkansas, with only minor contributions from Little Rock businesses. Imagine that. People who worked as maids and gardeners and porters, who just 2 decades before had been slaves, started and supported a college to train teachers and ministers. It was a real act of faith, an act birthed in the matrix of the history we've been describing. I often think of Arkansas Baptist when I think that life is getting too hard. And I confess I think of it too when I hear people in churches I serve saying, we can't make one dream or another come true because it's too hard. ABC always reminds me that we are all capable of doing hard things. The miracle of Arkansas Baptist College was the product of the affirmation in those churches, those Baptist churches, that God made all equal. The expectation they received there that their full humanity would be recognized if they worked together towards that goal, and the palpable presence of God in their services, testifying each week to this future reality.
In conclusion, Jolinda and I want to ask these questions. Why do you come to church? Social reasons? Theological reasons? To find some sense of liberation? To practice being human? Combination of all of these? Do you think that you proclaim anything by wearing what clothes you wear? Do you think you proclaim anything by your demeanor in church? Do you ever wonder what a fully integrated congregation assembling for worship and celebration on Sunday morning would look like? Do you think someone has the answer to that, but that you don't? Do you think there is an answer? Do you think there is just one answer? Is the Exodus story, the story of slaves leaving Egypt, meaningful to you in any way in your life? How about the story of Jesus? The story of Harriet Tubman? These are questions to live with for a while. But Jolinda and I think wrestling with such questions and then beginning to live the answers is a very good way to practice being human.